The fetus has no choice in being conceived and is conceived due to the choices of its parents.
It seems pretty clear to me that the baby is a trespasser.
The fetus emerges inside the property of the woman through the process of conception. There is no boundary for the fetus to cross.
I don't want murder to occur, but I ask, who has the property rights, the mother or the baby?
The existence of unwanted pregnancies does not necessitate a legal right to violence against the fetus.
Libertarianism is a theory not of what is moral, but a theory of what is legal. So I'm trying to find out what is the legal position on the abortion issue.
The resolution reads, while a pregnant woman should be legally required to help the fetus survive outside her body whenever that is possible, she should retain the legal right to evict the fetus at any time during her pregnancy. Arguing for the affirmative, Walter Block. Walter, please come to the stage. Arguing for the negative, Carrie Baldwin. Carrie, please come to the stage. We will now close the voting.
Walter, take it away.
Gene, thanks for having me, and thanks for doing the Lord's work here. I very much appreciate that. I am a professor at Loyola University, and speaking in behalf of most universities, this debate could not occur because it's hateful. Somebody's going to say something that's hateful, and that's no good, and we can't have anything hateful, but probably we'll have something hateful here, at least in the view of some people. The way the debate is couched is a whole sentence there. I would just like to put it down to three words. Let me take a survey here. Not that I can see everybody, but it seems to me that there are three positions on the abortion issue. You can be pro-life, pro-choice, or the view that I'll be espousing, evictionism. Evictionism means that you can evict the fetus, but you can't kill the fetus. So just with a show of hands, how many people are pro-life here? How many people are pro-choice? How many people are evictionists? Okay, it's about one-third, 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 and if I had a fourth choice of you're not sure, I'm sure I'd get 25% there. The point I'm trying to make is that this is a very divisive issue. Not only is the general public divided on this issue, but so are libertarians. Now, I'm going to mention two libertarians who have high libertarian credentials. Am I okay on this? Thing that keeps moving around. I'm moving it, but what the heck? It's I'm okay. We're okay. Good. Well, if I do it this way, when I say a P, then I'll scare everybody. It keeps moving. Not my fault. It's its fault. I don't like to brag. When it comes to blaming other people for stuff, I'm really good at that. Murray Rothbard is Mr. Libertarian, and Ron Paul is another Mr. Libertarian. These are our two leaders, and Murray is pro-choice, Ron is pro-life. You can't get two more libertarian credentialed people than those two. I don't think anyone would disagree with that. And yet they're 180 degrees apart from each other. Happily, we have me, little old me, who is going to solve this problem. And it's going to be a compromise position, and it's going to be a principled compromise position. What do I mean by a principled compromise position? If I say 2 plus 2 is 6, and you say 2 plus 2 is 4, a compromise would be 2 plus 2 is 5. It's halfway between. But it's not a principled compromise, because there's nothing from which you can deduce that 2 plus 2 is 5, except that it's a compromise. And my claim is that evictionism is not only a compromise, but a principled compromise. So who are the ball players in this game? Well, there are two choices. There's evictionism, which means taking the fetus out of the mother's womb, and also killing the fetus. Those are the two possibilities. It's sort of like, what is the libertarian view on labor unions? Well, they do two things, one of which is legitimate, the other is illegitimate. The legitimate thing that labor unions do is have a mass quit. If you can't quit, you're a slave. And just because other people are quitting doesn't mean that you can't quit. So if that's all they did, then we would support labor unions, or we would think that it's a legal activity. But they do one other thing. They call people scabs, and they try to stop the employer from having raw materials in or finished goods out or hiring people they call scabs, which seems a little hateful to me to call them scabs. But so the libertarian position on labor unions depends upon what the labor unions do. Well, I say that the libertarian position on abortion depends upon exactly what's happening. And there are, just like in labor unions who do two very different things, the situation in abortion also does two things, two very different things. One is to evict the fetus from the womb, and in the third trimester, the fetus will be viable. In the first two trimesters, the fetus will not be viable. That's one thing. The other thing is to kill the fetus. Now, the evictionist position is that you can evict, but you can't kill. The pro-life position is you can not evict. You have to keep the baby in there for 9 months, and you certainly can't kill. Whereas the pro-choice position is you can do both. You can evict, take the fetus out, like when a landlord evicts a tenant for non-payment, you just say leave. You don't kill the tenant, you just say leave. So the pro-choice position says you can do both. You can evict and you can kill. So what is the libertarian position? My claim is the libertarian position is eviction. Namely, you can evict, but you can't kill. Which leads me to the question, what is libertarianism? If we're going to have a libertarian position on something, we have to know what libertarianism is. And the short two-minute version of that is that libertarianism is predicated on two things. One is the non-aggression principle. Keep your mitts off of other people and their property unless you have their permission. Sadomasochism is okay. My SM joke is the masochist says to the sadist, beat me. And the sadist says, no. So sadomasochism is legal, not necessarily ethical, because libertarianism is a theory not of what is moral, but a theory of what is legal. So I'm trying to find out what is the legal position on the abortion issue. So that's the non-aggression principle. And the other is private property rights. Because suppose I were to grab that very nice scarf that the woman in the front over here is wearing, and I just sort of grab it and run away with it. Did I violate the non-aggression principle? Well, it all depends upon who is the rightful owner of that scarf. If she stole it from me yesterday, then I'm just repossessing it. Now, I never saw the scarf before. It's hers. It's not mine. So if I stole it from her, if I took it from her, it would be theft because she's the proper owner of it. So we have to have a theory of proper ownership. And the libertarian theory of proper ownership comes from John Locke, Murray Rothbard, Hans Hoppe. Other people have done great work on that. And it goes back to homesteading. Who was there first? If you mix your labor with the land and you put in a corn crop, you own the land. And somebody else domesticates a cow and now has milk, and he owns the milk. Now you can have trade. And the guy who had the cornfield now owns the milk, even though he didn't produce it, but he can trace it back to legitimate title transfer, voluntary trade, free enterprise, and private property rights. When does life start? That's an important question. My claim is that life starts with the fertilized egg. The sperm alone will not become a human being. The egg alone will not become a human being. The fertilized egg in the right environment will become a human being, and we all need the right environment. If we were on Mars without a spacesuit, we'd all die. Whereas there are some people who think that the fetus is sort of like a cyst or a tumor, which is crazy. I mean, if I went around with a gun and I shot a pregnant woman, but I didn't hurt the pregnant woman, I just shot the fetus and the fetus died, I'm not a murderer? Of course I'm a murderer. That's a vicious, nasty thing. Whereas if I coercively cut out a tumor of this woman, or maybe grab her and pare her fingernails, I kidnap her, I cut her fingernails, that's different. That's very different than a fetus. A fetus is a person. There's no difference between a fetus who is 1 hour from birth and a fetus who is 1 hour after birth. I have twin grandchildren. One of them was born first. Robbie, he was born first. And now he's out of the womb, and his brother, Ricky, is still in the womb. There's no difference between them. It's just a change of address when you get born. There's no difference. So the fetus is a baby. It's a human being. So I'm really pro-life. Some of my best friends are human beings. Okay, most of them. Not all, but some. Most. I'm pro-life. I don't want murder to occur. But I ask, who has the property rights, the mother or the baby? Now take the case of rape. Mother's walking along the street, she gets grabbed, she gets impregnated, and now there's a person, not a blob, not a tumor, a person is growing inside of her. That person is a trespasser. An innocent trespasser. The rapist father is the bad guy, but the baby is innocent. But he's a trespasser, he's in her property. She is the owner of that property. So what can you do if you have someone in your house? You go back to your house now, it's in the afternoon, you're going to go back to your house and you find someone in your house. Maybe the person is unconscious. Do you have a right to kill that person? No. But do you have to keep that person in your house for 9 months or for 9 minutes? No, you can evict that person. I think you have to call a hospital or an orphanage if it's a baby. You just can't let the person die. I think you have to evict the person, but you don't have to keep the person in your body. You can evict the person. Well, what about voluntary sexual intercourse? Doesn't the mother owe the baby 9 months' worth of occupancy? Isn't there an implicit contract that she has this? Now, look, I'm in favor of implicit contracts. You go to a coffee shop and you order a cup of coffee and you drink the cup of coffee and they present you with a bill for $1 million? No. There's an implicit contract that the price of the coffee has to be reasonable. If it's, a buck or two, fine. And if it's a cappuccino, maybe $5. But $1 million bill is way out of line. And there's an implicit contract that if the restaurant wants to charge you that, I favor price gouging. Price gouging is legal. Look, I have a wristwatch here I bought for $10. I'm now offering it for $1 million. Anyone want to buy this watch for $1 million? I'm price gouging here. That's okay. But if I give you the watch and you walk away with it, I can't charge you $1 million because we have an implicit contract that that sort of a thing can occur. So is there an implicit contract between the mother and the baby? Did the mother invite the baby? Remember, I'm talking about voluntary sexual intercourse now, not rape. In the case of rape, it's easy. That baby's a trespasser. She didn't want the baby there, and now she's got the baby there, and she wants to rid herself of it. She doesn't want to kill it, just rid herself of it. I say she has a right to do it, whereas the pro-life people would say, no, she's got to keep that baby. Well, now we're into voluntary sexual intercourse. Did she invite the baby in? Is there an implicit contract between her and a baby that she's got to keep the baby? No. Let me go back to biology. When the sperm enters the woman's body, it takes a little while for the sperm to get up to the fallopian tubes or wherever it gets. It takes a half hour. At the point of sexual intercourse, there's no baby. Remember, we said a baby is a fertilized egg. At the time of intercourse, there's no fertilized egg yet. There'll be a fertilized egg in an hour or a half hour, whenever it is. But for there to be an implicit contract, for there to be any kind of a contract, there have to be two people. The only time, the only exception would be a host mother. A couple is infertile, they give a sperm to the host mother, or somehow they get a baby in the host mother. She can't evict because she's got a contract. But a voluntary sexual intercourse, there's no contract. There can't be a contract because at the time of sexual intercourse, when the supposed invitation was offered, there was no invitee. The invitee doesn't come about until you get a fertilized egg. If you invite me for dinner tonight at 6 o'clock, and around 8 o'clock you start making hints, I got to get up early in the morning or something, and you sort of want me to leave, do I have a right to stay in your house for 9 months just because you invited me for dinner? No. I have no such right. So I favor evictionism, and I've given philosophical libertarian reasons for it. Now let me give you some pragmatic utilitarian reasons for it. If you're playing tennis and you hit to the guy's forehand and you're losing, what should you do? Try something different. Hit to his backhand. If you're a football team and the pass isn't working, go to the run. Try something different. Well, we pro-lifers are losing. Guess what? Abortion is all around us. That's the law of the land. So if we're losing, let's try something else. Let's try evictionism. That's one pragmatic reason for you all to adopt evictionism as the correct libertarian view. Another pragmatic justification is medical technology. See, right now, if we adopt evictionism, one-third of all babies are saved. Now, it would be nice to save all of them, but it's a compromise position. The pro-life wants to save them all, but it's losing. If we adopt evictionism, we save in one fell swoop one-third of all babies. In the third trimester, you can't kill anymore. You can only evict, and the baby is viable outside the womb. But with medical technology, every 10 years, it'll become a week earlier, maybe. You know that in 100 years or in 1,000 years, babies will be viable all the time. And if we adopt evictionism, we'll save all babies. Where if we stick our head in the sand and we stick to the pro-life position and the abortionists are winning, we're never going to get out of this. I rest my case.
Carrie Baldwin for the negative. Take it away, Carrie.
Thanks, Gene. I was a typical pro-lifer. I grew up in the movement, memorized the book on pro-life arguments, literally, majored in a scientific field to give me leverage. I was convinced that winning the abortion debate was entirely about logic. I got married, got pregnant, and left my newly budding career to become a stay-at-home mom. I continued debating abortion in online forums. But as I started listening to women explain the reasons for seeking abortion, my perspective began to change. I was still pro-life, but the solution was no longer clear. It was ambiguous, so much so that I stopped talking about abortion for roughly 10 years. In 2016, I sought a divorce from what I came to realize was an abusive marriage. Despite having a degree, I couldn't get a traditional job, certainly not one conducive to the life of a single mother. One day, I came across a YouTube video from a new anti-abortion group. It was a battle plan to make abortion first-degree murder, even if it meant the death penalty for the woman. A war on abortion, I heard, would look like the war on drugs. As libertarians, we know why this cannot happen. So I broke my silence with a constructive criticism of the pro-life movement. The issue is now clearer to me. You see, I had lived through what so many women are trying to avoid when seeking abortions, poverty and an abusive relationship. Conflict in this issue still exists and is escalating for one reason: compromise. Both sides compromise rights. Pro-lifers compromise women's rights in favor of the fetus. Pro-choicers compromise fetal rights in favor of the woman. So Dr. Block's offer of a principled compromise rings hollow to me. It seems to me that we need more than a compromise. I agree that property rights are the key to resolving the legal question of abortion, but I disagree with the resolution. A compromise, even a principled one, begets ambiguity. Murray Rothbard's purpose in using property rights was to show human rights are unambiguous. Toward this end, I argue that fetal eviction is illegitimate for two reasons. The fetus cannot be a trespasser, and claiming such diminishes women's rights. Allow me to explain. Evictionism is grounded in the aggressive act of trespass. A trespasser is someone who crosses a boundary without the property owner's permission. In this case, they also use the property owner for life support. But is the fetus a trespasser? No. First, the fetus never crosses a boundary. Sexual intercourse doesn't put someone in the property of the woman. Sperm are only gamete cells. The fetus emerges inside the property of the woman through the process of conception. There is no boundary for the fetus to cross. Besides this, studies in human embryology have found women don't control fetal development. The fetus does. It's autonomous and self-organizing. In other words, the product of human conception is a human that exhibits direct and immediate control over its own body. It's a self-owner, and it originates inside the property in question. Second, the fetus doesn't need permission to emerge. A woman changing her mind about pregnancy is compared to informing dinner guests that it's time to leave. Guests need permission to continue their stay or else it's trespass. But granting permission is not relevant to conception, because no woman grants permission for conception to occur. Conception is a sometimes unwanted yet involuntary process. suggesting a woman invites or disinvites a fetus, projects onto the woman powers she does not naturally have, that is, to voluntarily grant or rescind conception. More to the point, if granting permission were relevant, then all fetuses are trespassers. We all would have come into this world as criminals, since no woman grants permission for conception to occur. And if prohibiting pre-viable eviction is forced altruism, then not evicting is necessarily altruistic. So if all fetuses are trespassers and all women who choose not to evict are acting altruistically, then human rights are contingent, not absolute, grounded in the voluntary altruism of another, not in self-ownership. The invitation analogy is invalid. We cannot call the fetus a trespasser. The better analogy is the economic concept of production, specifically that a woman owns the means of producing new self-owners. But is the woman obligated to provide life support to a fetal self-owner? To answer this, we must ask if the fetus has an absolute right to life support, in this case, food and shelter. This is invariably where rape comes up. Volitional intercourse can produce new self-owners, but so can rape. So let's speak in volitional terms first. The fetus is a self-owner, but is not yet an actor. In other words, the fetus cannot yet choose. A necessary feature of human nature is developing the capacity to act. No self-owner chooses to become a self-owner. The fetus has no choice in being conceived and is conceived due to the choices of its parents, even when its conception was unintended. What Dr. Block and others have interpreted as an act of fetal trespass is actually the naturally created positive obligation the fetus holds against its parents since their action initiated the process that resulted in the fetus's self-ownership. Drawing life support from the woman is not an act of aggression. It's the natural right of the fetus. It's important to understand this about conception. It's an involuntary reflexive process initiated by sexual intercourse and results in the only product of human action to come equipped with its own rights. But Dr. Block says libertarianism opposes positive obligations. Positive law forces conformity to tradition or codifies arbitrary whim. These uses of the law are indeed anathema to libertarianism. But Rothbard said, we establish legal principles by discovering the natural law. Understanding natural woman is so vitally important here. Rothbard's position on positive law can actually be grounded in the natural maternal-fetal relationship. In other words, the reason why we cannot arbitrarily create positive obligations is because we lack the proprietary interest to do so. The state is literally not our mom. Positive obligations in parent-offspring relationships are compatible with libertarianism because they're derived from the natural law. So what about the woman's property rights? This is one area where pro-lifers consistently fail, but libertarians can get right. One thing that sets us apart as humans is our ability to choose against instinct and impulse, and in this case, to rationalize sexual relationships. Acting woman takes into account all that goes on within her own body as well as other data from her environment. She can neutralize bodily factors within certain limits to get her body under control. Her abstaining from these things are also purposeful. Action is the manifestation of a woman's agency, and her agency is paramount. A woman owns a particularly unique feature of human proliferation. She owns the means of producing new self-owners. Her agency entails a choice here. The evictionist error is supposing that women have a right to choose which self-owners will be evicted. But this implies that our rights of self-ownership are contingent on our mother's altruism. That's matriarchy, not libertarianism. Rather, women have a right to choose whether they'll use their property to produce new self-owners. But her right to choose not to produce new self-owners is naturally limited in the case a new self-owner is produced inside her. Her choice also entails using means to prevent conception, and there are good reasons to prevent conception. But some methods of contraception are not guaranteed. Using these means assuming the risk and unintended consequences should contraception fail. A woman bears the greater cost in reproduction, which means contraceptive failure is a greater risk to her. This is nonetheless her choice. This choice necessarily involves assuming her own risks. An unwanted pregnancy from volitional intercourse is one unintended consequence she assumes. But can she be relieved of this natural obligation? Yes. There are, of course, many reasons for unwanted pregnancy. Not wanting to be pregnant is a legitimate desire and goal. But the legal obligation to life support must be emancipated, either naturally or prematurely. Natural emancipation is simple. It's the child developing into an adult. Premature emancipation is the transfer of natural obligations to a voluntary surrogate. It excludes transfers that necessarily involve death of the offspring. So obviously, this excludes previable emancipation. This is not a denial of the woman's property right in her body. It's consistent with a natural limitation created when a new self-owner is produced. There is most definitely a market need created for the convenience of emancipating as early as possible. This is consistent with the state of nature, where without any technology, the earliest possible emancipation is at birth. So what happens when reproduction takes place through coercion and violence? What about rape? Current definitions of rape all seem to miss the mark. They fail to grasp the self-ownership of the woman. To do justice in situations of rape, we must understand how fetal self-ownership reveals what's at stake. So let's bring this full circle. A woman owns herself. She owns the means of producing new self-owners. This entails a myriad of choices that a woman has a right to determine within natural limitations. Sexual intercourse can initiate the involuntary reflexive process of conception that results in the production of a new self-owner and therefore creates a natural obligation. What does rape do then? Rape denies a woman's self-ownership. Rape seizes control of her means of production. Rape denies a woman's determination and power to control her body, her associations, assume her own risks, and imposes all intended and unintended consequences on her. Rape dehumanizes, in the Massesian sense, since the consequence of the physical, sexual, and psychological trauma causes her to behave more from impulse, instinct, and reflex. That's what rape does. Rape is not merely non-consensual sex. Rape weaponizes sex. Add to this the fact that rape can initiate the involuntary reflexive process of conception. We've been told these are reasons why previable eviction or abortion is justified in the case of rape, but these are actually the rights violations by the rapist. Presenting eviction as the necessary remedy for rape diminishes the crime of rape. Rape slips out the back door while we're busy arguing about whether the fetus is a criminal or a person or alive. Forget the fetus for a moment. Eviction or abortion for rape creates an inherent injustice against women. Our current legal system manifests this injustice. Think about it. In a state of nature where there is no technology for contraception, abortion, or eviction, where there is no legal system, if Crusoe rapes Jane, who is forcing Jane to carry an unwanted fetus? Crusoe. This is not the crime of the fetus. It's not even the legal force of the state. By using coercion or violence, Crusoe violates Jane's self-ownership, denying her agency and dehumanizing her. He seizes control of her means of production, and he creates a natural limitation on her by initiating through force the involuntary reflexive process which produces a new self-owner within her property line and against her will. It's the rapist's use of force at play when a woman carries an unwanted fetus from rape. It's the rapist restricting the woman's liberty interest. The legal principle we can deduce here is not eviction, because the fetus is not the criminal. The legal principle deduced is restitution, owed by the rapist to the woman and to the fetus. Restitution is about making the victim whole again, but you can't do this by granting license for one victim, the woman, to do violence to a second victim, the fetus. And the fetus is not doing violence to the woman, it can't even act. In fact, granting such license is using positive law to codify arbitrary whim, since it's not within the power of natural woman to end fetal life. Now, it's foolish to suppose that writing a law will end a behavior. Ending abortion can only be achieved by mitigating the felt need for it. But the existence of unwanted pregnancies does not necessitate a legal right to violence against the fetus. It does necessitate free market solutions. A free market empowers women. But the fetus cannot be a trespasser. It doesn't cross a boundary, it doesn't need permission to be conceived, and it has a natural right to life support. Fetal trespass diminishes women's rights. It reinforces the lie that rape is a passing moment that sometimes leaves women with nothing more than an inconvenient moral conundrum. The whole point of a libertarian theory of abortion is to disambiguate this issue. The status quo of women's rights is already compromised. Our rights have always been subjugated to the rights of men, the interest of the state or the church, or even our offspring. Using property rights to absolutize fetal rights absolutizes women's rights. A libertarian legal order demands justice for the woman. It demands the rapist pay for his crime, and it denies the illegitimate use of force even by women. Women's rights do matter, but we cannot see them clearly until we draw a line in the sand. Women have the most to gain from a freed market and a libertarian legal order, but not if we're left with a compromise. Thank you.
Five minutes to rebuttal from Walter. You can get up there if you want. Yeah, Walter.
Yeah. I must have published 15 or 20 articles on this subject, mostly in some prestigious law reviews, other less prestigious law reviews, and also in many scholarly journals on property rights. And yet, I think that her view on this is easily equal to the best of them and probably better than most of them. So I'd like a round of applause for her. The problem with this, from my point of view, is I'm much more visual than auditory. I'm much better at reading something than I am at hearing. And I don't know that I'll do full justice because this is the first time I've heard this. So I order you to write this up, stick in a few footnotes, and get it published. And then I'll be able to do much better justice to your views than I am now. So please forgive me if I don't fully understand everything, but I'll do my best. I agree with what she said about abortion being first-degree murder. It is first-degree murder because remember how I define abortion is evictionism plus killing. So if you kill innocent people and the fetus is innocent, you're a murderer. And the doctor who does that is accessory to murder I'm not sure what the legal term is, but he's a bad guy. And the woman is a bad guy for killing when she need not kill in the third trimester. That baby is viable outside the womb and they kill the baby with partial birth abortion. That is perhaps the most despicable thing known to man. Well, maybe there are other despicable things, but that's high up on the list. To tear apart a little baby and pull the baby out is just horrible. And yet, that's what the law allows now. I didn't really get the idea of ambiguity. I think that this is not ambiguous at all. It clearly says that you can evict, but you can't kill. I don't see any ambiguity there. Yes, there's some ambiguity in the sense that the baby in the first two trimesters will die, whereas in the third trimester it won't, but I don't see that ambiguous. It seems pretty clear to me that the baby is a trespasser. Now, my learned opponent says all fetuses are not trespassers. Well, I would say all unwelcome fetuses are trespassers. She says none of them are trespassers. You need altruism. But take the case of rape. The woman is walking down the street. She gets grabbed. She gets impregnated. And now there's a person growing inside of her. Now, it's true that that person isn't doing it purposefully. He's innocent. He's not, cutting her or hurting her, not purposefully anyway. He's kicking a little. I remember when my kids were born, my wife was kicked from the inside. Babies kick, but, we're not going to count that as violence. But you don't have to be violent to be a trespasser. Look, suppose I make someone unconscious, an adult, and I stick them in your room. That person is a trespasser. He's innocent. He didn't do it. I drugged him and I stuck him in your apartment or in your house. So I don't think you have to do anything to be a trespasser. You just have to occupy someone else's property without their permission. And it seems so clear to me that in the case of rape, that's exactly what the fetus is doing. Now, this business of positive obligations, again, I'm not sure I'm doing justice to my learned opponent, but we libertarians see positive rights as anathema. I mean, now you have welfare rights, a right to food, a right to clothing, a right to shelter, a right to this, a right to that. The only rights compatible with libertarianism are negative rights. We all have a right not to be murdered. We all have a right not to be stolen from. We all have a right not to be raped. We all have a right not to be assaulted. Unless we agree to be in the boxing match and someone punches us in the jaw, you can't call assault and battery because you agree to be in the boxing match. But apart from that, we only have negative rights. If we had positive rights, then the welfare system would be justified. So I don't see that anyone, and the baby, the fetus, the child who's 3 months in the mother's womb, is a baby with all the rights that other people have. And the only right that anyone has, including a baby inside the womb, a preborn baby, is not to be murdered. But, yes, it's true that in the first two trimesters, if you evict the baby will die. But that's justified because we have a choice between who is the proper owner of the woman's body. Is it the fetus or is it the mother? Well, the mother was there first. Homesteading theory says that the first owner of the property is the owner of the property. The fetus came afterward. The mother is, 25 years old. The fetus is 25 minutes old or 25 days old or 25 weeks old. She owns that body. And if somebody is sitting there, not doing violence, but just sitting there, that's a violation of property rights. Look, you can have a lot of crimes that are not violent. Pickpocketing is very delicate. Fraud is very delicate. Bad check writing. You don't have to have punching or shooting to be a criminal. You can have nonviolent criminality. That baby is a criminal. An innocent criminal, but a criminal.
Five minutes of rebuttal from Carrie.
So there are two nuances at play in this debate, the negative right to not be aggressed against and the question of positive obligations. A woman carrying an unwanted fetus is not merely upholding the fetus's negative right. She is also passively providing shelter and a food supply. Passive action is still action, and we certainly want to avoid establishing a principle which makes lawful the positive obligation to provide food and shelter, or anything else for that matter, to any random person. In Dr. Block's view, the only way to do this is to reject any and all notion of positive obligations. And the only way to achieve this in a situation of unwanted pregnancy is to declare the fetus a criminal of some kind, granted an innocent one. To do this, Dr. Block begins with the strongest premises from both sides of the abortion debate, the woman's bodily autonomy and the fetus's rights-bearing status. He then employs the situation of rape to derive a rule for unwanted pregnancies and volitional situations. Now, this is common practice in philosophical argumentation to begin with the hardest case. And there's no doubt in my mind that rape is the hardest case of unwanted pregnancy. But why? Is rape the hardest case because it's the equivalent of someone temporarily stepping on your property and leaving you with an inconvenient moral conundrum? Or is rape the hardest case because of the implications of absolute self-ownership? If our rights of self-ownership are absolute, then we conclude where Dr. Block begins. Where Dr. Block assumes these premises for the sake of making a cogent argument, I'm reiterating why these premises are true in the first place. Evictionism contradicts the absolute rights of self-ownership. If it says we all began our lives as criminals, and the only reason why we weren't justly evicted was because our mothers altruistically ignored our crimes against her. A woman should never put up with the crimes against her. But the fetus is not committing a crime. The fetus cannot be a trespasser. It doesn't cross a boundary. It doesn't need permission to be conceived. It has a natural right to life support. This obligation may be legally transferred to a surrogate, but not at the cost of the offspring's life. The fetal right to life support, food and shelter, is only held against the parents. It's not held against any other person. The positive obligation exists in a closed circuit, which explains why positive obligations cannot be legislated by anyone. No outsider can legally invent children's rights and thus centrally plan the family. And no outsider is legally obligated to provide life support for children. If we are not honest about what is inherent in natural woman, that she owns the means of producing new self-owners, then we undermine the rights of women. And both sides of the abortion debate have done this. The conservative pro-life view errs by relegating women to the secondary status of incubators, existing for their utility because of what men are biologically incapable of. In cases of rape, they emphasize moral heroism for keeping those babies. This also diminishes the crime of rape by romanticizing it. The pro-choice view has relegated women to secondary status by perpetuating the lie that the remedy for unwanted pregnancy is violence. Meanwhile, rape remains the least likely of violent crimes to get a conviction, and where there is a conviction, rapists are often given leniency. Rape culture is not a product of male privilege. It's a product of state privilege and judicial malfeasance. The evictionist view is self-defeating. It doesn't uphold Rothbard, it falsifies him. Rothbard was correct about property rights as human rights, but he misapplied it to abortion. Dr. Block is correct about trespass, but he misapplies it to the fetus. My view resolves these anomalies. It takes into account the right of women to choose what to do with their bodies within natural limitations, while revealing for us why rape is such a horrific rights violation. Absolutizing fetal rights absolutizes women's rights. A libertarian theory of abortion should not attempt to compromise the existing failed paradigm. What the existing paradigm gets wrong is their presumption of the inevitability of rape and their distorted sense of justice. Libertarianism corrects the paradigm by absolutizing the self-ownership of both women and offspring, and this means fetal eviction is illegitimate as a libertarian theory. Thanks.
Thank you to both, and we now get to the Q&A portion of the evening, and I think we have a mic where people can line up. I do have a couple of questions as for moderator's prerogative, but meanwhile, we're pretty open-ended, and if either of you want to put a question to the other, then you can do so at any time, or perhaps you want to wait for the questions and then see. But anybody want to exercise that prerogative at this moment to ask a question to the other?
Have a criticism of Kerry.
It's got to be a question.
My criticism is calls me Dr. Block.
Okay, yeah.
I would like her to call me Walter and invite me to call her Kerry. That's my big criticism.
Okay, that's well taken, Walter. And otherwise, I have a couple of questions for Kerry. First, my puzzle is this sort of a critical leading to a question. If where children are wanted, where the fetus is wanted, where it was intended to have a kid and raise the kid, then presumably that's not altruism on the part of the mother. That's the desire to be a mother. And therefore, the mother does not regard the kid as a trespasser, but as sort of a welcome visitor. And therefore, if I understood you correctly, you said that the implications of the evictionism that all babies are brought into this world as criminals, presumably not in the case of where, you know, if you and I were ever wanted by our mothers, then we were not criminals when we were born. Would that be valid as far as you're concerned, what I just said?
As far as...
Wanted children who are wanted.
Okay.
They're not wanted by altruists. They're wanted by people who want to become mothers. And similarly, since they are wanted, they're not regarded as trespassers. They're welcome visitors. So would that be valid as far as you're concerned, to the extent that the kids are wanted?
So I don't think that wanted is the condition necessary, because you have situations where women want to get pregnant and they can't.
Yeah.
And so I emphasize the fact that conception itself is an involuntary process, because you can want it to occur and it won't occur if you struggle with infertility. So not wanting it can't be the other condition. If you engage in volitional intercourse, then there are natural consequences to volitional intercourse. And maybe you don't want to experience all of those potential consequences, which is why we use contraception. But contraception isn't guaranteed, which means that if contraception fails, we're subject to the natural consequences that may occur. So wantedness isn't really the condition necessary for understanding the rights of the fetus, because ultimately wantedness is still an aspect or an element of altruism. You either want to extend mercy to a child or you don't. You either want to have a family or you don't. But if our rights are based in self-ownership, and Rothbard said that that self-ownership is absolute and primordial, by the way, although I think he intended that in the historical meaning, but I intend it in the biological meaning. If our rights are absolute, then part of what forbids her from evicting, pre-viability specifically, has to be based in something absolute and not something contingent, like whether or not she wants it. Does that make sense?
Not sure, but I'll let that pass. Do you have a comment, Walter, to make, or do you want to go on?
Well, I agree absolutely with the point that you're making. I wish I had made that. Shut up and let me make it.
What?
I think it's absolutely true that if the baby is wanted, it's not a criminal. He is not. I shouldn't say it's. The baby is a person. He or she is not a criminal. I just wanted to add one thing about this crossing a boundary. Look, I have this power. I'm going to shoot you people. And what's going to happen is you're all going to get pregnant. The men, too. By the way, men can get pregnant, according to the latest politically correct woke thing. Men can get pregnant. And also,
the resolution is only about women, so stick to the point.
Oh, no. Men can get pregnant. Arnold Schwarzenegger got pregnant in one of the movies, remember? So men can get pregnant. And now what I'm doing is I'm shooting you all with this ray gun. I've got magical powers. And now there's a baby growing inside of you. Did he cross a boundary? I don't know. I don't care. I don't think crossing a boundary is the key to trespassing. It doesn't matter how the baby got into you. The baby is into you. You didn't want that baby. The baby is a trespasser. So I can't go along with Kerry's view that there has to be a boundary crossing. The only boundary that got crossed in the case of rape is the sperm went into the woman's body. Mm-hmm. So, but then that's not the baby. The baby doesn't come about until there's a fertilized egg. So okay, I'll grant to her that there's no boundary crossing. But I don't think that a boundary crossing is sufficient, but it's not necessary to be a trespass. Again, I'm shooting you now, and you're all pregnant, and there was no boundary crossing except this ray gun that I shot, but the baby came from within you. The baby didn't cross any boundaries. The baby just erupted or came to life inside of you due to my magical powers. The baby is still a trespasser, even though there was no boundary crossed.
All right. Kerry, just one final question for you as well. With respect to rape, if I understand you correctly, you're saying that the rapist violated the woman, the fetus is an innocent bystander, an innocent victim of the circumstance, and that the woman should bear the baby to term, but then claim restitution for the rapist. Is that correct?
So I would say that she has, I would use the word emancipate instead of evict, and she would have a right to emancipate post-viability. So she could still deliver early in order to not have to deal with, you know, an unwanted fetus from rape. But the crime against her, right, with the rape, doesn't give her the power to then use violence against the fetus. What she's owed, what the woman is owed, is restitution.
Yes.
From the rapist.
Well, yes, I understand. But then did I hear you say you prefer to use the word emancipate? The woman can emancipate the fetus from her body. Did you say that?
Yes.
Okay. So, and that, whereas Walter would characterize that as evict the fetus from her body. So in the case of rape, it's just kind of a semantic difference between you and Walter. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think most of our difference is pre-viability.
Pre-viability.
I would say all of our differences are pre-viability. We agree 100% on post-viability, namely the woman can emancipate or evict or eject or whatever you want to call it. That's just semantics. The key is in the first two trimesters now. But right. With medical technology improving, okay. It'll be a little early.
But the first two trimesters are okay with you in the case of rape? Is that right? Yes?
No, she's obligated. Because that's a self-owner, and that self-owner has a right to life.
She should bring the baby to term.
Not necessarily to term. She can emancipate, but the cost should be written off onto the rapist.
She should bear the baby so that the baby survives. Is that
right?
Correct?
Okay. Yes.
The baby's got to survive. Okay.
Baby's got to survive, whether it's to viability or to term.
She's got to make sure the baby survives even if it's rape. Okay.
Right.
All right. Okay.
I have a question. Can I ask Carrie?
Good question. Go ahead.
Do you acknowledge that my position is better than the pro-choice position?
Is it better?
Better from your perspective.
Sure.
It's an improvement because we're one-third agreed, if not two-thirds.
Yes.
Okay, good.
Yes.
Thank you.
One-third better. Okay, question. Yeah.
Take what you can get.
Question.
Question. Take it away. Just ask the question.
Question for Dr. Block. I believe that
Walter.
His...
Walter.
I believe that his argument is basically grounded in contract. That's what he said. I think a key to that is the fact that there is no party to contract with when the act is...
And your question is what?
The question is, what about the concept of a tortious creation of life? The act of either the man or both result in, say, a negligent creation of life. And so the fetus could be owed a duty... under a tortious theory.
Tortious?
Tort.
Tort.
T-O-R-T.
A tort, yeah. That the negligent or irresponsible or responsible act of the party or parties involved resulted in this life being created, and the fetus is now incurs all sorts of obligations to itself that are not its fault. It's the fault of others. It's there's no contract basis needed here. It's like if I hit if I hit somebody with my car, I owe them a duty even though I had no contract with them. So that's I'm just wondering how does the you could have a tortious
basis.
Okay,
yeah. Your question's clear. Go ahead.
Well, I certainly agree that if you hit somebody by accident, not on purpose. If it's on purpose, it's a crime. I'm sure you'd agree with me that. But if you hit somebody with your car by accident, you owe them a tort. Namely, you have to repair the car and certainly pay their medical bills if needed. But I don't see that you owe any fetus anything because you didn't commit anything against them. Namely, you improved the fetus's position, it seems to me, because you gave him life. So I think you're the benefactor of the fetus, even if the fetus only lives for a couple of weeks. So I would reject the point, but I think it's a very important point, so I thank you for it.
Carrie, any comment on the question?
Well, I would object to even the notion of implied contract or implied consent because, again, a woman doesn't actually invite the fetus into her body. This is an involuntary process. And what's interesting is that when you start talking about invitation or implied consent, that incidentally is language that gets transferred over into rape situations where we're asking, did the woman invite the rape? So I would say that there is no even implied contract between the woman and the fetus. You have to know when you've entered into a contract. Neither the woman nor the fetus has any such knowledge. So I wouldn't even use that kind of language.
All right. Next question.
Hi, Walter. This is both for Carrie and Walter. In terms of legal government legal policy, should there be a precise point such that up to that point, anything goes, and after that point, it's first-degree murder? Or should there be a gray zone? So I said up to point A, anything goes. Maybe you can disagree morally or humanely if you want. And after point B, it's first-degree murder. But in between, there's a rising scale of penalties and hoops you have to jump through to get around the penalties, starting with misdemeanors and bigger misdemeanors and so forth.
You understand the question?
Yeah, I do understand the question. I don't have to repeat it because I'm trained to repeat questions, but everyone heard the question as well as I did.
Yeah.
I would say that Carrie and I agree, if I can put words in her mouth, that in the third trimester there should be no crime of evicting because the baby will be alive. We just disagree in the first two trimesters, and she says that it would be a crime, not just immoral, but an actual crime to evict the baby in the first two trimesters because the baby will die. And I say, yes, the baby will die, but it's a true compromise position that I'm offering, a principled one, I think. So I think that if you evict you can evict the baby at any time.
I guess
you just can't kill the baby ever.
The baby
will die in the first two trimesters, but that's legitimate according to libertarianism, as I understand libertarianism.
I think the question was, the gray zone between when the second trimester ends and the first one starts. I guess, Walter, you would basically say that the physicians in the presiding would be obligated to try to get the baby to live, and if it's the best efforts, then the courts the law doesn't have to be involved.
Right. The doctors should make their best efforts, yeah, and the woman to keep the baby alive. There are these cases that Ron Paul talks about where the baby is viable, and they put the baby in a bucket and let the baby cry and die. I mean, that's sort of super duper disgusting.
It could be. I guess there could be some gray areas. Do you have a comment, Carrie?
Yeah, I do. One thing that I noticed when I was studying your papers, Walter,
atta girl,
was that, you know, you've got this distinction, this eviction plus killing, right? And one thing that I learned in my research was that the way abortion has been done in the past, or at least one of the methods, was literally eviction plus killing. Like the mother would actually be given medication to induce early, and it would be done by a perinatologist, not an abortionist, and she would deliver the fetus. It wouldn't be viable, but they would treat it as they would a miscarriage. And so the woman was given an opportunity to grieve the baby. She would hold it until it died, that sort of thing. But the way that abortion is done now is much, much different. You don't have the distinction of eviction plus killing. It's a distinction really of killing plus removing a dead body. I mean, even the two most common methods of abortion in those first two trimesters, you have medical abortion, which is where they use a drug that's typically used for cancer, which causes the fetus to detach from the uterine lining, and it starves and suffocates the fetus. And then she takes the second pill that basically induces labor, and she expels a dead fetus. So that's not eviction plus killing. That's killing plus evacuation of a dead body. The other one is surgical, which is using a vacuum to dismember. So neither of those two methods really fit that distinction anymore of eviction plus killing. It's a completely different method.
Do you have a comment, Walter? Or do you want?
Well, I think Carrie knows a lot more about this situation than I do, so I defer to what she said.
Okay. Question. Yeah.
I'd like to know what the two of you think about severely disabled fetuses.
Carrie, answer the question.
Yeah, sure. Thank you for that question. You know, there are a multitude of disabilities that a fetus can develop. And I think the question that we need to ask ourselves is, do disabled people still have a right to live, even if it's a short term? Even if it's going to be a difficult life. Now, do we get to make that choice? If I see a disabled person in the audience, do I get to make the choice of whether that person, whether their life has value or not? No, of course not. They have a right to their own property, their own self-ownership. And so even a baby that has disabilities would still have retained that right of self-ownership. There are other disabilities that are so difficult that they are said to, they're not going to have a very long life. And in that case, usually what happens, medically speaking, is the nurse, the doctor, they might opt to have an early delivery and allow the parents to enjoy the life with that, with their baby, even though it's eventually going to die. That's still something. That's still granting and understanding that they have that right to self-ownership, even if it's a short life lived. We don't all have a guarantee that we're going to live a long life. And if we don't have a guarantee that we're going to live a long life, that shouldn't cut short our right to our self-ownership in our life.
Comment?
I agree with Carrie 100%, which shouldn't be any surprise because we're both libertarians and we agree on 99.8% of everything. We just disagree on one or two things, one that I know about. I wanted to add to what Carrie said, with which I agree wholeheartedly and enthusiastically. There was this case in Florida where there was a comatose woman and she was brain dead, which you can't get more disabled than that. And she was brain dead. And the husband wanted to pull the plug. And the reason was he had another lady he wanted to marry, and if she was still alive, it would be bigamy, and he couldn't marry the other lady. And the judge, unfortunately, went along with him. My view with the relation of parents and children is you can't own the child, but you can own the right to bring up the child, namely to be the guardian. How do you maintain the right to be the guardian of the child? By guarding. Well, if the husband wanted to pull the plug, that shows immediately that he's no longer the guardian. The parents wanted to keep the plug in there because a miracle might occur, and they were willing to pay the cost of it, and I think that the judge erred in saying that the plug could be pulled. As long as there's one person on the planet that wants to save her and is willing to pay for it, she should have been allowed to stay alive, because who knows, a miracle could occur. Tomorrow they could come up with a cure for brain dead or whatever the problem is. So I support Carrie entirely on this one.
Next question.
Hi. I didn't hear any reference to punishment for abortion in, let's say, the first trimester. A libertarian or ANCAP view would never be a proponent for country A invading country B for doing something country A didn't like. So it seems to me that it's the same of police arresting a woman getting an abortion. It seems to me a consistent libertarian could never be pro-life because that would require the state.
The involvement of the state, you get the general drift of that question, Carrie?
Yes, I'm really glad that you asked me that question. So obviously we're talking about a libertarian legal order, and I'm even personally myself a libertarian anarchist, and in an anarchist society you still have a legal order. It's called a polycentric legal order. But, you know, if you were to ask me how this current government should enforce an abortion ban, I would say it can't. Okay, and an authoritarian government is incapable of enforcing a libertarian idea, because they're using positive law, because of the police state. I mean, one of the big concerns, and it is a legitimate concern, I think, is that with a police state in an authoritarian situation, if we're treating a war on abortion like the war on drugs, then you have to consider even miscarriages as suspect. And that is a nightmare. And so if you're going to ask me what should the state do now, it should not touch me and leave me alone. And we need to get a libertarian legal order. Because otherwise it's just six in one, half dozen in the other. They're either going to violate the rights of a woman, you know, we've seen that happen in the drug war. I don't need to really describe that. But they're either going to violate the rights of women or they're going to violate the rights of the fetus. So what we need to do to actually implement this is work on the freed market and getting a libertarian legal order. Now, once that libertarian legal order is in place, you have things like presumption of innocence, for example. You know, so you don't have a law enforcement agency that is suspicious of everything. And if somebody has evidence that a woman has had an abortion and they want to charge her with that, they would obviously have to go through a legal process, go to, you know, a legal dispute, a third-party dispute agency is the term they use for anarchism. So that process would still occur. But you don't have the situation that you would have now where miscarriages are suspect, and, you know, we're using women as informants and trying to make favors and still throwing them in prisons. I mean, the victims of the drug war are the drug users, right? The victims of a war on abortion would be women. There's one person who stands in between the fetus and the rest of the world, and that's the woman. And so I could not dream of a police state enforcing any sort of ban on abortion.
You probably agree with that, Walter, right?
No, absolutely not. I disagree with this. I was going to say I hate to ruin the debate by agreeing with her once again, but here, happily, I disagree with her. I think that if you get an abortion in the third trimester, you're guilty of first-degree murder. You're a murderer. Now, it might be hard to catch you. I don't care about that. That's just pragmatic utilitarianism stuff. I'm interested in libertarian justice. You are a murderer if you abort a baby that could live outside the womb, period. But I wanted to add this thing about one country invading another country. I was once in a debate with Richard Epstein, and Gene over here criticized my part of it by saying that I only answered as an anarchist. And now I'm going to try both. Based on what Gene said, as an anarchist, as Kerry said, yes, we still have laws. If you steal something, even under an anarchist society, you will be punished. And now I want to, and the disanalogy is if one country invades another country, the reason we shouldn't invade Venezuela is not because the Venezuelans are good. It would probably be a good thing if the Maduro were deposed. It's because. Now speaking as a limited government person, not as an anarchist, the function of the government is to protect the people in the United States, not to go abroad and help the Venezuelans. So I see this analogy there. Now just because it's, and I also reject this analogy between the drug war. I don't think anyone should be penalized in the drug war because it's a victimless crime. But this is not a victimless crime. This is a victim. The baby is a victim. This is just first-degree murder. And if it's difficult to... Look, it's difficult to find first-degree murderers ordinarily. An adult kills another adult. It's not easy to find the person and prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he's there. Should we get rid of the law against penalizing murderers? Of course not. Well, this is murder. This is downright plain murder to kill a baby in the third trimester who could live otherwise.
Next question.
Hi. I first want to say that I really enjoyed both speakers. They're very erudite and articulate, and I've learned a lot from both speakers. That said, the reason I agree with Walter and disagree with Kerry, and the reason that the law of the land is allowing women to have control of their bodies. The reason I disagree with you, Kerry, is that you really cannot speak about women's rights and take your position. There is no way you can have it both ways. It's literally one precludes the other. And that's why I agree with Walter's position, but I really enjoyed your development of your ideas. Very erudite, very interesting.
Yeah. Well, that's good. Yeah, but the statement, Kerry, is you can't talk about women's rights and have Kerry's position. Do you want to address that challenge, Kerry, or do you want to pass? What do you want to say? Yeah. You can pass. You got complimented.
I guess I'm not sure I want to open that can of worms. I think women's rights absolutely matter. I don't think that we live in a world where the fetus's rights and the woman's rights are opposed to one another. I do think that the way the current paradigm exists has sort of taught us to think that way. And certainly you have, I'm going to criticize the pro-life side. Now, the pro-life side has definitely downgraded the rights of women when it comes to motherhood. I've heard some absolutely absurd statements come from them, and I think they should, stop making those statements. I think they need to, that first criticism, when I broke my silence and I made that constructive criticism against the pro-life movement, I said, what the heck is your goal? Is it to save fetal lives, or is it to prosecute women? And because those are two different things. If we want to end abortion, if we want to save lives, that means mitigating the felt need for it. That means the woman standing in her bathroom, staring herself down in the mirror because she has a pregnancy she's not prepared to have. We don't want her having to sit there with a pill in her hand thinking, this is my only option. Right, we want her to have options, and that's why I think that the solution is in the free market. We want to maximize her options that way. Obviously, I think that she shouldn't have the right to kill her fetus, but The difference between my view and I think the conservative pro-life view is that the conservative pro-lifers aren't actually trying to maximize her options. They're just trying to take away this one thing, which our society has sort of said, that's it. Like, if you have an unwanted pregnancy, it's no good options or abortion. And I don't want that for her either. I want to maximize her options. And yeah, we take abortion away, but maximize all of her options over here so that she has the best opportunity to make a better decision. I hope that helps.
Let me ask Carrie a question. What option would you give to a woman, a pregnant woman, that the conservative pro-life people wouldn't? Or did I misunderstand you?
What options would I give?
Yeah.
Well, I think part of the pro-life argument is that they want to sort of get rid of this idea of wantedness, right? It's not good enough that a woman doesn't want her pregnancy for them. They want to change her mind and get her to want a pregnancy. And that doesn't really work, right? There are many good reasons to not want to be pregnant. And those aren't illegitimate. And so they have a tendency to vilify unwantedness. They also have a tendency to say, you have to carry it to term. Now, I would say you have to carry it to viability at least, right? So, and that viability, yeah, I agree, will be moving back closer and closer to conception, and we should definitely move medical technology forward that way. So that would be another way that my offer is different than the conservative pro-life view. Yeah. I hope that answered it.
Yeah, no.
Looks like we have time for just one more question, though. So go ahead with your question.
This question is for Carrie. When it comes to the restitution for a rape victim, if the rape victim were to carry to viability and the baby at that point died during delivery, would you hold the rapist accountable for that death as part of the restitution?
That's a good question. I guess the first question I would respond with was, how did the baby die? You know, if it was just a natural death, I'm not sure that you could hold the rapist responsible for that. You know, but if there was an unnatural death, you might. But I don't know exactly. I'd have to look at the exact circumstances.
One more question, I guess. We can squeeze in.
Can I comment on?
No, please. No, I'm sorry. We can't comment. We just have to have the question. You can talk. You can talk later with the Carrie. Yeah. Go ahead, please. Question.
Yes, my question is for Walter. In relation to the idea that you can't have an implicit contract with someone who doesn't yet exist, my question is, if I were to hire a hitman to murder the children of someone, even if those children don't yet exist, but then he would carry that out when they were born, would I still be responsible for their deaths?
Well, yeah, I think so. I mean, there's no implicit contract. It's true the children don't yet live, but you've paid this guy $10,000 to kill someone else's kids when they're born. You're a bad guy.
Nice try. Okay.
I don't mean you personally.
That was perhaps our most creative question of the evening. Is a note we're going to end on. Carrie, do you have any comment on murdering someone? You probably agree with Walter. Anyway, we have concluded the Q&A, and Walter gets to summarize. Walter, do you want to check?
Carrie and I were speaking before the debate, and we were very friendly then and very friendly throughout, which is what I like. And what I said, and she agreed with me on this, is that we're really doing two things here. One, we're having a debate, and it was a good debate, but we're doing something else, and that is we're engaging in a cooperative venture, not just the two of us, but the whole kit and caboodle here, to get that 1 millionth of an inch closer to the truth with a capital T. That's what we're really trying to do also. I mean, I'm not trying to deprecate that it is a debate. It is a debate, but part of the debate is give and take and thesis, antithesis, synthesis, and trying to get a little bit more, and I think I've learned a lot from Carrie, and I hope she's learned a bit from me.
There were several times that Gene wouldn't allow me to speak. He's a rotten kid. No respect. I'm older than him. He should have more respect for me. So I'll devote some of my time to what I would have said. There was talk of women's rights. There's no such thing as women's rights or men's rights. No such thing as handicapped people's rights or non-handicapped people's rights. No such thing as white rights or black rights or fetus rights or adults' rights. They're just human rights. And all we have, according to libertarianism, is the right not to be aggressed against, and that's it. So I don't think we should make such distinctions. There's another issue that we didn't bring up, and that's women's health. Sometimes they say, well, you can have an abortion if it's to save the woman's life. And there I agree. I'm a moderate. That's why they call me Walter Moderate Block. I'm very moderate. I mean, there was this example in one of the things I read, and some of these philosophers are very ingenious. And what it said is, suppose the baby starts getting bigger and bigger, and the baby will get so big that it'll kill the woman. Does the woman have a right to, and this is in the third trimester, and the only way to get the baby out of there is to kill it first? Does the woman have a right to do it? And now what we have is you can't have both people live. Either the baby lives or the woman lives. And I say the baby's rights come second to the woman's rights because the baby is a trespasser. So that would be the one case where I support abortion, not just eviction, if it's to save the woman's life. I wanted to raise another issue that hasn't been raised, and that is, suppose you and your a couple, husband and wife, you come home, you bring the baby from the hospital, and you leave it in the baby's crib, and now you don't feed the baby. And the baby dies. Did you commit a crime? And I say you did. You have an obligation to bring that baby to a hospital, an orphanage, or a church, or a synagogue, or at least tell somebody who might want the baby that here's a baby available. But doesn't this conflict with no positive obligations? Because I also have the view that there are no positive obligations. This sounds positive obligation-ish, that you have a right to get off your rear end. You have an obligation to get off your rear end and take that baby to a fire station or a police station or something. And my answer to that is bagel theory. Sometimes I say donut theory, but we're in New York, so it's bagel theory. So what's bagel theory? Picture a bagel. Can you homestead land in the bagel format? Namely, you homestead this, but you leave 1 square mile in the middle of it? No, you can't. Why can't you? Because then you would be control, and I'm assuming no tunnels under, no bridges over, no pole vaulting, no nothing, no helicopters. You can't do that because then you would be controlling unhomesteaded land and preventing other people from getting it. I once had a Hasidic rabbi friend of mine. We discussed this, and he said, well, if you did the bagel theory, you have to allow egress through your property so people can get there. Well, what's that got to do with the baby? What's that got to do with the baby? Is the baby is like a hole in the middle of the bagel? It sounds a little awkward, but, you know, the point is that if you kept that baby in the back room and didn't feed the baby, what you would be doing is controlling a resource, the baby, that other people want, and you're no longer homesteading it. You see, I believe that you can have absentee ownership. You own land, you can be an absentee owner. But with a baby, it's different. The only way you can have the rights to be the guardian of the baby is to guard the baby. And you stop guarding the baby. As soon as you stop guarding the baby, you no longer have a right to that baby. So if you don't bring the baby to an orphanage or a hospital or something like that, what you're doing is similar to what the guy who homesteaded in the bagel theory, and you're not allowed to do that.
Kerry, your 5 minutes of summary.
So about a month ago, I read an article by Caitlin Flanagan at The Atlantic. It's entitled "The Dishonesty of the Abortion Debate." Flanagan captured the quintessential nature of why coming to consensus on abortion appears impossible. She takes a pro-choice stance, but I admire her own brutal honesty summed up in this statement. The argument for abortion is made, if made honestly, requires many words. It must evoke the recent past, the dire consequences to women of making a very simple medical procedure illegal. The argument against it takes not even a single word. The argument against it is a picture. End quote. So we know this is a baby. We know it's a human life. We know it has rights. And certainly I would agree with Walter that there is no such thing as women's rights. Now, there certainly is rights of women. And the rights of women have been subjugated to the rights of men, to the rights of, or to the interest of the state, and even to the rights of the fetus. Throughout history, this is true. And so we've always had, at some point, secondary status. So when we talk about the rights of women, it is meaningful. It is not merely, I think, this... It's not merely this idea of self-ownership. A woman does have self-ownership. But that has been subjugated throughout history. And so what I am arguing is that if we absolutize the rights of the fetus and say it does have a right to occupy the mother, then we are absolutizing the rights of women. We understand much more clearly what is going on when she gets pregnant. We understand much more clearly what is going on when she is making decisions about her life, about her career, about who she chooses to have sex with, and that sort of thing. That has so much more meaning when we understand that what she is capable of is producing new self-owners. So by absolutizing fetal rights, we can absolutize the rights of women. And I think that's what the libertarian position on abortion is. Thank you.
Thank you to both of you. It was indeed a cooperative venture, but it's also a debate. Only one of you can win the Tootsie Roll. It could be a tie. That's true. That's true. And we've had ties in the past. It very rarely happens, but every once in a while it does. And I forgot to bring the Tootsie Rolls. I'm going to send them to you later. We are now open the voting. Hermie? Again, you're voting finally on the resolution. While a pregnant woman should be legally required to help the fetus survive outside her body whenever that is possible, she should retain the legal right to evict the fetus at any time during her pregnancy, yes, no, or undecided for your final vote. While you're voting, a couple of retrospectives. We do have, as Nick mentioned, a dedicated podcast called The Sowell Forum Debates that you can access. All the debates we've ever had, more than 35, are available on that podcast. We also have videos of all of our debates. I was very gratified that the recent video I did with Richard Wolff on socialism versus capitalism has, in the space of a little over 3 weeks, gotten over 200,000 views on YouTube. And thank you. Yeah. And I was personally pleased that I not only won the debate by Askford-style rules, as my friend Rudolf Hauser has said, this time I didn't yell at the guy as I did at Bhaskar Sankara when I debated him. And so I won without yelling, and therefore it was a very character-building experience for me personally. So if you haven't watched that debate between me and Richard Wolff, then you might want to do so or go into the Soul Forum Debates podcast and listen to the debate. And Monday, January 6th, that's going to be, you know, 6 days after New Year's, but hopefully you will have sobered up by then. And that will be Monday, January 6th, best-selling author and Silicon Valley entrepreneur Martin Ford will defend the resolution, robotics will soon lead to widespread joblessness, underemployment, and the concentration of wealth in the hands of a few, against Anthony Samaroff, co-host of the Scottish Liberty podcast. That's Monday, January 6th. Tickets are on sale for that. Tuesday, February 4th, it's going to be me again. That's going to be me against Heritage Foundation Distinguished Senior Fellow Stephen Moore, who will defend the resolution, President Trump's trade-related initiatives against China deserve broad public support. he will take the affirmative, I will be taking the negative, and there we will have Nick Gillespie returning as guest moderator. Hermie, interrupt me anytime you feel that the vote is finalized. But Walter mentioned Richard Epstein. He's going to make a comeback, and on Monday, March 7th, we're getting Columbia Prof. Tim Wu. Tim Wu is, of course, quite prominent, and he's from Columbia. He's the author of The Curse of Bigness, and he will defend the resolution, antitrust should take the initiative to control the size of the big tech companies. NYU law professor Richard Epstein will be taking the negative. That's on March 7th, and our big sellout event where we're going to have a much larger hall. We're going to have this one at John Jay College, where we had my original debate with Bhaskar Sankara, a hall that seats 450 people, more than double the size of this hall. That will be William Crystal, who has graciously agreed to debate at the SOA Forum. William Crystal wrote this resolution himself. He will defend the resolution, a willingness to intervene and to seek regime change is key to an American foreign policy that benefits America and the world. Against Scott Horton, author of Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan. Once we announced that, we sold out very quickly for that event, so we decided we better have it in a much larger hall, and tickets are still available for that event. Go on soaforum.org to look at all our events. Debates are scheduled through July of next year at this time. Hermie, do we have the results? Okay, thank you. All right. Voting. The yes vote for the resolution was 33.85%. That gained 13.85 points. It went up to 47. Oh, my God. Hermie, it went off. Actually, I have it memorized. It was indeed very close. You picked up a little over 13 points, and Kerry picked up a little over 12 points. The difference, Walter, you had 13.85% that you picked up. Kerry picked up 12.31. It was very close. It was a difference of a little over a point. Kerry ended up with 38% of the vote. Walter, you ended up with 47%, but Walter gets the Tootsie Roll. Congratulations to you both.